Thank you for coming. I'm excited to be here today to share with you some research that I've been working on with my co-author, Dr. Amy Hillier, exploring patterns of food purchasing and dietary quality in Chester, Pennsylvania. So before I go any further, I have no relationships to disclose. This research is driven by my interest in understanding the role of time in both food security and food access. And the study seeks to better understand the dynamic food acquisition patterns of low-income shoppers by using a receipt collection methodology to evaluate how shoppers manage resource constraints with monthly benefit allocations, as well as what role emergency food networks play in the food security and dietary quality of low-income shoppers. This study is exploratory and is primarily a proof-of-concept study to test the methodology of receipt collection as a means for assessing temporal patterns in food purchasing and dietary quality. To give you a little bit of background and framing for the research, food access research to date has been primarily cross-sectional and has been focused on spatial definitions of access. So this means looking at distance to and availability of healthy food resources. We've seen this manifest both in the literature as well as in the policy at both the local and federal level. A good example of this would be funding to support the introduction of new grocery stores in underserved communities. But evidence is increasingly demonstrating that geographic and environmental metrics of the food environment are not sufficient on their own to determine access or to shift health outcomes. So in my research, I'm endeavoring to challenge this spatial definition of food access by exploring what role time, and particularly the constraints of cyclic benefit distribution, plays in both the food security and dietary quality of low-income shoppers. So borrowing from the food insecurity literature, which examines availability of resources over time without really taking into account the spatial dimension of food access, I'm endeavoring to look at both food access and food insecurity over both time and space. And for today, I'm going to primarily focus on the temporal piece, but my future research will integrate the two. So one place where we know that this cyclic or temporal pattern exists is among SNAP users. And for those who aren't familiar, SNAP is distributed typically once per month within the first 2 weeks of the month. And we know from the SNAP redemption data that, on average, SNAP participants have spent more than 75% of their benefits by the end of the second week after receiving them, and that the majority of SNAP recipients exhaust their benefits before the end of the month, so before they receive their next distribution. And researchers have termed this the SNAP cycle. And this is really a temporal problem. People are running out of money, but they're also experiencing episodic food insecurity. We know that from the research also that calorie consumption decreases over this SNAP cycle. And this has serious implications for health, as both of our previous panelists discussed. Among other health implications, we know that food insecurity is associated with behavioral and cognitive development issues among children, as well as metabolic shifts that can lead to obesity. So in my research, I'm curious to discover if the same pattern exists with dietary quality. We have this end-of-the-month question. What happens as people's SNAP resources run out? And is the dietary quality of the foods that they're receiving affected by visiting a food pantry? And then what happens if we bring back in that spatial question, if people live either close to or far from a grocery store, does that have an impact on their dietary quality over the monthly cycle as well? So my primary research questions for this study were, what role does time, specifically the monthly SNAP cycle, play in dietary quality? And how does the use of emergency food resources impact the food shopping and food consumption cycle? So a little bit of background about the study. The research took place in Chester, Pennsylvania, which is a city 13 miles south of Philadelphia. It has a population of approximately 35,000. 75% of whom are African American, and roughly a third of whom live below the federal poverty line. And as you can see from this map, Chester is a community that's been heavily underserved by full-service food retail outlets. And until the fall of 2013, Chester had no supermarket and was a USDA-designated food desert. So we used a convenience sample to recruit 45 participants in Chester. Participants were asked to collect all of their food shopping receipts for food items to be consumed at home. They were also asked to maintain a food log on which they could record any food items that they acquired for which they did not get a receipt. So that could mean if they went to a convenience store and they weren't provided a receipt, or if they visited a food pantry or got a donation from their church or a gift from a friend. At the end of the study collection period, each participant met with researchers to have an in-person interview. We went over each of the receipts line by line to clarify all of the items that they had obtained. At this time, research staff also recorded the transit mode that was used to reach each shopping or food acquisition destination, as well as the starting and ending point for each food shopping trip. Receipts were then scanned and manually entered into a database, and items were coded for nutritional content using an energy density measure that I'm going to discuss further in the next slide. And then for this particular analysis, I selected 10 matched pairs from out of those 45 receipt collecting participants. The pairs were matched based on household composition, income, and employment status. And within each pair, one household had visited a food pantry during the prior month, and one household had not. I then compared the amount and helpfulness of food acquisitions across both the pantry and non-pantry users for the four-week period. And just a bit of information about this study sample, so just these 20 households that I compared in this analysis, 88% of them were African American, 70% had children under the age of 18 living in the home, 65% had an annual income below $15,000, and 90% received SNAP benefits. So there was just one matched pair that was not receiving SNAP benefits. So all of the food items in the database were classified according to a nutritional coding system of obesity-promoting and obesity-preventing foods, and this coding system was adapted from and validated by prior receipt collection studies. And this coding system focuses on food groups that are associated with obesity and diet-related disease risk. So items were coded primarily as being either low-calorie, LCF foods, and you see that in the top of the slide there. This includes fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy. Or as high-calorie, less healthy food options, and this includes things like sugar-sweetened beverages, sweet and salty snacks, and refined grains. These categories were delineated based partially on research by the World Cancer Research Fund's energy density category, which classifies foods with fewer than 100 kilocalories per 100 grams as being LCF, or low-calorie foods. Items that were similar to either the LCF or HCF categories, such as fruit drinks that were made with non-100% juice, were designated as excluded items by this coding system. And then lastly, all other foods, which you see on the bottom, such as meat, whole grains, baby formula, eggs, were coded as other and were not included in the primary analysis. Obviously, this coding system is just one way to analyze nutritional quality. It leaves a lot of food categories out. But it does speak to some of the biggest policy concerns that we have right now around diet, around obesity, by specifically focusing in on the food items that are recommended either for increased or decreased consumption. So as I mentioned in the beginning, this is an exploratory study. The sample size was really too small to draw any statistically significant or generalizable conclusions. Really, we were just hoping to see if any patterns emerged around this temporal question of food access and dietary quality. And we did see some really interesting patterns come out of the data. The first one was around food spending. Spending decreased dramatically over the course of the month, going down 72% from the first week to the fourth week of the month. This means that in the first week, households were spending an average of $80 on food purchases, which comes out to about $21 per person in each household. And by the fourth week, it was down to just under $6 per person in each household, so a really big shift. And this drastic decrease in food expenditures is consistent with the SNAP literature that I mentioned earlier and is evidence of this episodic food insecurity that I've discussed. So the second major trend that we saw in the data was around the nutritional composition of foods over the course of the month. The percentage of spending on LCF foods, and again, this is fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy, decreased in a linear pattern over the four-week period. While the percentage of spending on the high-calorie foods, and that's sugar-sweetened beverages, sweet and salty snacks, actually exhibited a U-shaped pattern. So you see that the percentage of spending went down in the first several weeks and then actually went back up in the fourth week. And this U-shaped pattern can be seen a little bit better here in these bar graphs, especially among the pantry users. And this pattern is consistent with a recent study that came out of Baltimore examining dietary quality in consumption as opposed to purchasing over the SNAP cycle. The researchers on this study in Baltimore hypothesized that we may be seeing this U-shaped pattern due to the fact that items that have a high fat content are more shelf-stable, as well as to the relative inaccessibility of fresh fruits and vegetables later in the month when people's SNAP benefits have been depleted. So the last big trend that we found in the data was contrary to much of the literature that I've seen on nutritional quality of emergency food, which has shown a relatively lower availability of healthy food items among food pantries. However, among this sample, the food acquisitions actually had a higher concentration of the low-calorie foods and a lower concentration of the high-calorie foods than among the food items that participants were purchasing for themselves. This suggests a potential health protective effect of emergency food resources, not just for food security, but also for dietary quality. So in this pie chart, you can see all of the food items that all 20 households purchased over the course of the whole month, broken down by food category. And then when you look at the breakdown of just the pantry acquisitions, you can see that the percentage of LCF foods, particularly fruits and vegetables, is significantly higher than among the items they were purchasing. And then when you compare the pantry users to the non-pantry users, all of the food items that each of them acquired over the course of the month, you can see this higher ratio of LCF to HCF again. So because this study was exploratory, I really wanted to evaluate the strength of the receipt collection methodology as a means for evaluating spatial and temporal dimensions of food insecurity and dietary quality, and kind of hone in on asking the question of what this method offers that others don't, and what its strengths and weaknesses are. I think the biggest strength of this methodology is that it provides a measure of food acquisition over time. It's not cross-sectional, and it gives us a picture of how people's food purchasing changes over, albeit a fairly short monthly cycle. It also provides a huge level of detail. Not only do I know that people visited the food pantry and received fruits and vegetables, but I know whether they were fresh or frozen or canned. I know whether items were high fat or low fat or diet. Because we've asked people to maintain receipts and logs for all of the locations from which they acquired foods to be consumed at home, we have a very comprehensive picture of people's food purchasing and food acquisition patterns, and we can get a really big, good sense for where they've gone over the course of the month. And then lastly, because we've recorded the transit modes and the starting and stopping locations for each trip, we're able to do trip chaining and look at sort of the broader shopping behavior patterns that people are using. And this brings back in the spatial question. This is just one map of some of the explorations I've been doing around how to integrate this space and time dimension. This map represents just one participant in the study. The gray dot in the center was their home, and the blue lines represent each food trip that they made over the course of the month and to which type of food outlet they went. So in conclusion, the major limitation of this data collection method is that it's incredibly labor-intensive. But I do think after having run this pilot study that the benefits of obtaining such a rich data set really do outweigh the downsides of such labor-intensive data collection. And for next steps, I'd really like to refine the data collection method with the addition of some qualitative research so that I can get a better sense for people's motivations and perceptions in terms of their food purchasing. And I would also like to incorporate scanning or smartphone technology for their food acquisitions so I can get a more accurate read specifically for the foods for which they didn't have receipts, so the food pantry items in particular. And in conclusion, this research has really refined my thinking and instigated some new future research questions that I'm excited to explore around how these spatial and temporal dimensions of food access and food insecurity are interacting. So we know that there's this issue around periodicity of resources, and we also know that a lot of communities are experiencing limited physical access to stores. And I'm curious to discover how these two problems interact and whether one problem is compounding the other. And obviously, this raises some policy implications around potential redesign of SNAP benefit distribution, which of course brings up more research questions. I know that's the classic researcher stance. We need more research. But I'm curious to look at what impact changing benefit distribution would have on the shopping burden of SNAP shoppers, as well as what role food pantries could play in smoothing some of these temporal cycles.